on? It's on. Good afternoon, everybody. Can you hear me? Yes, good. Okay, you're all very welcome to the FCC. My name's Anna Healy-Fenton, and I'm the president, as I'm sure by now you're tired of hearing. A couple of small matters of housekeeping before we get started. Could you please remember to turn your phones back on when you leave? And just to say, we have another speech this week, lunch speech on the 19th, which is Hans Timmer talking about global economic prospects for 2012. Now, John, I'm sure, needs no introduction. We've been hearing about the 49ers since 2001. Just to recap, these were the guys who lost their jobs over a row over terms and conditions when they were summarily fired by Cathay. They've taken legal action in different countries since then. The longest bout of legislation has been in Hong Kong. In the High Court, their action was upheld and they received damages. The Court of Appeal then overturned a substantial amount of their damages award and said that their original employment terms and conditions didn't stand and were overridden by Hong Kong law, which is considerably weaker than their Cathay terms and conditions. And that, I think, is John's main point today, that this isn't just a talk about the 49ers, it's about anybody who has a job in Hong Kong and how the courts regard Hong Kong working conditions and or don't regard them. Anyway, the latest chapter is taking it to the Court of Final Appeal, which is the next and final stage. So over to John. Oh, he will talk, then we will do questions. So when we get to questions, could I ask everybody to put up their hands and wave very definitely if they want to ask a question.
Thank you, Anna. Can everyone hear me? There's a ringing noise in the background here, but anyway. How does that do? Is that better? Good. Okay. Okay. First of all, I'd like to express my thanks to the FCC for giving me the opportunity to come here and talk to you. And also my thanks to all of you for coming here to listen. And I'll try not to waste your valuable lunchtime. The Cathay Pacific 49ers, a pilot's perspective. I'm not actually sure that we've got that title right. I'm amongst some journalists here, so maybe you can help me. Does that imply some kind of ownership of us? Certainly they created us, and they spent the last 10 years trying to disown us. So I don't know, do you have to own something before you disown something? Anyway, title of the book, The 49ers, The True Story. That was published in March last year. And for those of you who either haven't read the book, shame on you, or who aren't familiar with the story, I'll try to summarize for you basically in the time I've got available what happened. But before I do that, I want to make a crucial point to all of you here, and that's this. That what started out essentially as a local industrial issue between Cathay Pacific management and its pilots, in the intervening 10 years, has metamorphosed into an industrial confrontation that has spread to other countries worldwide. But now, here in Hong Kong, it directly affects every man and woman who are working under a contract of employment in Hong Kong, no matter how senior or junior you are in your chosen profession or jobs. So it's not just about the Cathay pilots anymore, and I'll explain later why I say that to you. Okay, so the roots of the dispute can be traced back to 1993-94, when the management philosophy and ethos in Cathay changed fundamentally, and they embarked on a process of business process or corporate re-engineering. And the changes that took place over the ensuing years gave the pilots cause to become very concerned about their careers, their contractual terms, particularly where rostering is concerned. And rostering for a pilot rules his life. The roster rules a pilot's life. Rostering and seniority are the two most important issues, two of the most important issues in the pilot's contract. Coupled with this at the same time, the pilot's trade union, let's use the proper word, the Hong Kong Aircrew Officers Association, who at that time represented the pilot's interests, became increasingly concerned about the effects that some of these changes were having on operational flight safety. time constraints here stop me from going into detail, but suffice it to say that the whole situation escalated when it came to the point on the 9th of July 2001 that Cathay's response, management's response to this dispute, was to sack 49 pilots all in one day, hence the term the 49ers. In fact, in truth, they sacked another three pilots around the same time, but the 52ers doesn't kind of roll off the tongue quite so gracefully as 49ers. But they didn't just sack us. That wasn't enough. They went further than that. They tried to make life as difficult as possible for us, and they tried to force us out of Hong Kong. They misreported our income tax to the authorities so that we were all faced with swinging income tax bills, massively overestimated. And because they told the tax people that we were leaving Hong Kong, we were forced to pay these bills within 10 days. It was a huge financial penalty, and many of the guys couldn't afford it, and it took us months to get our money back. Some people received letters from their banks saying their credit cards were revoked, and they even went as far as to cancel housing leases where they were held in Cathay's name to throw these people and their families out on the street. But even that wasn't enough. They then set about destroying our careers and our reputations as well. Careers and reputations that some of us had spent 30 years building. Their mouthpieces, Tony Tyler and Philip Chen, held press conferences and made statements about us that were completely untrue and unfounded. These lies spread like wildfire through the international media. International professional aviation is a very small community. Surprisingly, it's a small community. The International Federation of Airline Pilots Associations membership roll shows there's only around 120,000 professional airline pilots in the world. It's a small community, and the word spread very quickly. And the result was that we were effectively blacklisted in the international community by all of the major airlines. We were unable to get any form of equivalent alternative employment, and basically, we were pariahs in the profession that we spent our lives devoted to. That was the immediate effect of their malicious and vindictive campaign against us. But in the medium term, because people couldn't get employment, people lost their houses, marriages broke up, families were broken up. And there are two young men and one young woman who are no longer with us. They lost their lives, they're dead. And in my opinion, the reason those three people aren't with us anymore is a direct result of what these people did to us. We didn't take it lying down. In 2001, we started filing legal cases, and we filed cases in four separate jurisdictions. We went to Australia, the US, the UK, and here in Hong Kong. Now, for various reasons, the cases in Australia and the US were discontinued. But in 2006, in the UK, we went to the House of Lords, and we won. House of Lords, the highest court in the land, we won. And the case is called Crofts versus Vita Limited. Vita's a subsidiary company of Cathay, and that's now quoted as case law. The point here is the ruling didn't just apply to Cathay pilots, it applied to all peripatetic employees. It's a good word, that means they move around a lot. It means that any person who's employed by an offshore registered brass plate company registered in Hong Kong, Cayman Islands, Ouagadougou, or wherever else, but are employed basically based out of the UK, now enjoy the protection of the UK Employment Rights Act. So it's not just the Cathay pilots based in the UK. It applies to offshore rig workers, it applies to commercial divers, all peripatetic employees. Now, I've said peripatetic twice now, I'm not going to try and say it again. The Employment Rights Act in the UK confers certain rights on an employee, such as protection from constructive and unfair dismissal, and significantly, the right that if you're dismissed, you have to be given written reasons. We don't have any such rights here in Hong Kong. So basically in the UK, that was a turning point that we achieved in employment legislation, that we got these employees under the umbrella of the Employment Rights Act. Case in Hong Kong, that took us longer. It wasn't until 2009 that the High Court handed down its judgment in our favour again on all three legs of our case. We filed three legs. The first one was that they'd acted in breach of the employment ordinance here, S21B2B, which basically gives you protection against dismissal or victimisation for being part of a trade union. They upheld that. The court held that that's what they'd done. They'd breached that ordinance, and that's a criminal offence. We also filed for breach of contract. In our contract, we had a discipline and grievance procedure expressly included. They gave reasons for our dismissal, saying that we had misbehaved or various other things, but they didn't invoke the discipline and grievance procedure before they fired us, so we held that they breached our contract. The judge agreed, upheld that, and awarded us damages. And they also agreed that Tyler and Chen's public statements were untrue and they were defamatory, and he awarded us $3.5 million in damages. So that was great. And it seemed that after 8 years, we'd finally got some measure of justice, even though $3.5 million went nowhere near compensating us for the actual financial loss we had. It was still a record defamation award here in Hong Kong, so we set a precedent. Unfortunately, our joy was short-lived, because the dark side, sorry, Cathay appealed the judgment, and on Christmas Eve 2010, the appeal court judgment was handed down. First thing, good news, it upheld the S21B conviction, sorry, the S21B award, agreed that the overarching reason why they fired us was because of our union membership and participation in the activities. So it confirmed that they committed a criminal offence. It also upheld the defamation, that Tyler and Chen's words were defamatory. It upheld the defamation, but they reduced the damages, our defamation damages, by around two-thirds. The other thing they did was they overturned the breach of contract ruling. They said that effectively the employment ordinance gives the employer the right to terminate your contract on notice, irrespective of other terms that may be included in your contract, such as our discipline and grievance procedure. So this wasn't the best Christmas present I've ever received. In fact, it was about the worst, even worse than the socks and aftershave my mother sends me every year. But they did uphold two legs of our case, but they overturned the third and they reduced our damages. So at first sight, you might think, well, the worst part is the money. And if you're just looking in financial terms, certainly it was. It was a bitter blow to us. But if you look at the breach of contract ruling, it's got far greater implications than simply money, which is why I say that every man and woman working in Hong Kong is now directly affected by our case. Because if it's allowed to stand, it doesn't matter what's written in your contract of employment in the form of protections against unfair dismissal. It doesn't matter what might be written in there for discipline and grievance procedures. It doesn't matter what's in there to give you security of tenure. If it's allowed to stand, according to the law at the moment, the employment ordinance gives the employer the overriding right just to call you in, give you notice, no reasons given, no questions asked, that's it, you're on your bike and you're out of here. And you've got no redress. This applies to everyone. I've already made the point, it applies. You could be a professor with a chair at the university, all the way down to the tea lady. Not that I'm denigrating tea ladies, you understand? Wouldn't do that. They provide an essential service. But if the employer can call you in and just dismiss you like that and keep his mouth shut, that's it. You have no redress. This is where actually Tyler and Chen made their mistake. When they fired us, if they'd kept their mouths shut and not gone out into the media, we would have had a lot more difficult time of it as 49ers in our court cases. Fortunately, they couldn't keep their mouths shut, so that's great. It's hard to see how this can be right. You know, if two parties enter into a contract, you have to expect that the two parties, there's some mutual trust between them, there's respect between them, and they both expect that each other will abide to the terms of that contract. If there isn't that kind of trust, what's the point in having a contract? And it's especially employment contracts, which is accepted in UK legal circles now, are a special form of contract because they directly affect people's lives. Our employment ordinance here, unfortunately, lags far behind what there is in protections in other jurisdictions. We don't even have here the right to collective bargaining. Chris Patten tried to put that on the statutes just before he left as the last governor, but one of the first actions of Tung Chee Hwa when he took over was to repeal it. So if two parties include protections in the contract of employment, then clearly it's the intent of both of those parties that you should adhere, that both parties should adhere to that, and within that relationship, and you should expect to be able to, you're the other party, to look after, to adhere to those. But according to this Court of Appeal judgment, no. Take the argument one step further. This could apply to holidays, it could apply to sick leave. What's to stop an unscrupulous employer attracting you here and giving you a contract that says you've got 5 weeks leave a year? And then when you get here, refusing to give you that and only giving you the statutory days off that are in the employment ordinance. Well, according to this, what's your redress? Well, according to what the Court of Appeal has said at the moment, you have none. This, as I say, I don't see how this can be right. And if anybody here can persuade me otherwise, then I'm all ears. Please tell me, because I don't understand. So what can we do about it? The obvious answer is to enact new legislation here, but I wouldn't hold your breath on that. Labour organisations here have been lobbying for years and seem to have got nowhere. I mean, one of the simplest things you could do is put in that you are required to be given written reasons for your dismissal. At least that would put a stop to the sack them and keep quiet. Unless, of course, they were going to say the reasons are is because we can do it in Hong Kong. Well, we now may still be able to do something now. We've got an opportunity here because we are going to the Court of Final Appeal, the last stop on our legal marathon, and we're going there on the 27th of August. And if we can get the Court of Final Appeal to overturn that judgment, then maybe we can make a difference. But it's interesting, actually, how we got to the Court of Final Appeal. The process is that you have to first apply to the Court of Appeal to go to the Court of Final Appeal. And we had to apply to the exact same three judges that handed down the ruling in the Court of Appeal. And guess what? They turned us down. Now, no surprises there. I would, if I was in their position, I probably wouldn't grant leave either, because it might be implied that actually you made a bit of a mistake in your decision. So it seems an extra process. We had to go through it. They turned it down. And actually, when that happened, it was reported in the local press here under banner headlines, Cathay pilots lose, Cathay wins, etc., etc. The next step was to go to the Court of Final Appeal and ask them for leave, and they granted it, saying that the case was in the public interest, which indeed it is. Strangely, and I'm sitting here amongst journalists now, strangely, our success, there was hardly a mention of it in the local press at all. I don't know why that was. If anybody can tell me the real reason for that afterwards, I'll buy you a beer. Let's hope, ladies and gentlemen, the Court of Final Appeal sees the merits of our case like the original judge in the High Court did. Because if they don't, then I'm afraid a contract of employment here in Hong Kong isn't worth the paper it's written on. You might as well hang it up in the lavatory. You have no security of tenure. Your job can be terminated on a whim, whether your job's permanent or otherwise. And in fact, there is no permanent contract under these terms because the permanency of your contract is merely the length of notice written in the employment ordinance. And it's hardly Asia's world city, and I don't think it's a great way to attract people here to come and work. So, in summary then, the 49ers, pilot's perspective. If you want to know the full story, read the book. It's on sale for just over $300, and at 600 pages, I'm sure that you'll all agree it's a bargain. And Ursula over there will very gladly take your money. The story's all in there. The things we did right and the things we did wrong. Successes and failures. And as well as it being a story that needed telling, one of the reasons I wrote it was to try and help people who might find themselves in similar situations to what we found ourselves in. And if it goes any way at all to helping other people, then I'll realize one of our objectives. But I come back to the point I made at the start. This is no longer just about Cathay Pacific pilots. It's about all of you sitting here in this room. It's about your friends. It's about your families. It's your colleagues, your spouses, your partners, everyone. If the current status quo is allowed to maintain, none of you have any protection at all against an unscrupulous employer simply taking away your livelihood on a whim and consigning you to the dole queue. It can't be right, ladies and gentlemen. It can't be right. And if any of you in this room have any influence at all through lobbying or whatever in helping to get this verdict reversed, then now is the time to use it. Okay, thank you for listening. And if you've got any questions, I'll take them.
Thanks very much, John. Now, for questions, can you please raise your hand and identify yourself? The staff will pass around microphones. I've got the light shining in my eyes, so help me out here, folks. Over here.
Thank you, John. I have been following this over the years in the papers.
Sorry, could you just identify yourself?
Oh, sorry, my name is Daryl.
Whistler's mother.
Sorry, Daryl Smith. I have been following this in the papers, John, and I see that the original management is no longer in place. So I'm just curious if the new management, if they've done anything differently in their HR and management procedures or their ethos or the way they handle things as a result of this.
Well, I don't work for them anymore, so I mean I can only go on, I suppose, my own evidence. If we go back, let's say 2006, when George Crofts succeeded in the House of Lords, a Cathay spokesperson was reported in the press as saying, the verdict makes no difference to us. As far as we're concerned, our opinion of Mr. Crofts hasn't changed. There's no place for him on a Cathay Pacific flight deck. 2010,2009, after the verdict was handed down by the High Court, within 2 weeks, the then Director of Flight Operations of Cathay, Nick Rhodes, wrote another newsletter about us, which he knew was going to go out into the media, and he repeated the defamation. He repeated one of the defamatory remarks about us. So in response to that, we filed another defamation suit against him, which is still ongoing, and they've made no attempt to settle under equitable terms. And in fact, 9 months ago in this very room, Tony Tyler was asked a similar question about would he do the same thing again, and he replied, yep, I'd do it all again. So, from the evidence I've got, as I say, I don't work for them, but from the evidence I've got, I don't see there's been any change in the ethos at all. They have never, throughout all of this, shown any remorse. They've never at any time offered to apologize for the things that they said about us. Not at all. They've never made an approach to us. So in answer to your question, my view is no. I mean, yes, certainly, the people that instigated all this, Eddington, Turnbull, Tyler, Such, Chen, they're all gone. So those players are out of the game now. I mean, after 30-year careers with the Swires. But I see no evidence that the ethos changed at all, is my response to your question. Maybe it has, I don't know. They've got a new managing director, John Slusser. Maybe he's going to change things. But you still have the same people sitting in the big house, in the Swire House. I don't see that anything's changed there, no. I hope I'm proved to be wrong. But right at the present time, I think not.
Right, John. Do you know what you actually did wrong to get sacked in the first place?
Yes, I was president of the union, and then for 2 years, and after that I was the chief negotiator, and they couldn't get what they wanted out of me across the negotiating table, so they got rid of me. My personal file and my record are impeccable. They have nothing on me, I have no disciplinary letters, no nothing. They sacked me because I was the union president and I was the chief negotiator, and they couldn't get past me.
Hi, Paul Weatherald. Thanks, John, for that. That was great. I was just wondering, is the effect of the ruling just limited to employment law, or does it tend to put a bit of a torpedo in any sort of contract, in any sort of contractual relationship in Hong Kong? Because, I mean, companies have lots of contracts with lots of people, and they wouldn't like to have the terms of their contracts varied either.
You'd have to ask a lawyer that one, mate. I've become something of not an expert, I'm not going to use that word, but I know quite a lot about employment law now as a result of 10 years. I know quite a lot about defamation law as well. I don't know, maybe there is a read across. I mean, that's something that you'd have to ask a lawyer. Maybe there is a read across to other forms of contracts. I don't know the answer to your question.
Hi, George Russell. I work for the CPA's magazine here in Hong Kong. I'm just wondering if you feel a little bit of you might be pushing against the tide of history in terms of a lot of people here don't have traditional employment contracts that we might have remembered. Look at the aviation industry. It seems to be a low-cost business. Do you feel that you're going to have a bit of a struggle to sort of return to what essentially were 1980s employment contracts? And not just in your industry, but generally in Hong Kong and elsewhere.
It depends what protections you're talking about there. I don't see that having a discipline and grievance procedure in your contract that should be adhered to is any form of draconian 1980s, go back to Arthur Scargill type operation. I mean, I think having a DNGP, a discipline and grievance procedure, that both sides adhere to give you a fair hearing if you're supposed to allege you've done something, I don't see that as going back to the NUM days. Quite clearly, the employer's got to have a right to be able to terminate the contract. I mean, that's obvious. Nobody's asking for a job for life. But there should be constraints and protections in there where you're not just going to be fired on a whim. You know, you say that somebody doesn't like you across the dinner table, that's it, you're in the office next day, you're out of here. I'm not looking go back to the bad old days when, unions, I don't think unions should have as much power as they used to have. I mean, I grew up in Yorkshire in the time of the miners' strike. Scargill brought down an elected government. They should never have enough power to do that. But equally, employers should not just have such draconian power that we go back to the Victorian days. There's a balance to be found in everything. But yes, we are struggling uphill. We've been doing that for 10, 11 years. That doesn't mean to say it's going to be difficult. But that doesn't mean to say we can't do it, and it doesn't mean to say we won't stop either. There's a guy out on the veranda there.
I don't need. Okay, I'll use one of these. My name's Malcolm Prentice. I'm an ex-British Airways, ex-British Caledonian. I'm not a technical type person. I'm ex-British Caledonian, ex-British Airways. Been retired for a long time now. I'd like to make a comment about the previous question. To my mind, a lot of people in Hong Kong are here on short-term contracts. A lot of people in the banking industry, and they are short-term people. In the airline industry, you start at the bottom and you work up. It's a seniority system, so you give your life to the airline. Question I would like to ask is, because of the One World Group, in which BA is a participant, do you see any form of collusion between management and any... What do you see as a future, if you do see that far?
Well, pilots. The pilots have the International Federation of Airline Pilots Associations. So we've got Hong Kong ALPA here. You've got US ALPA in the States. You've got airline. You've got BALPA. Okay, and then we all meet for annual conference once a year under the heading of the IFALPA conference. And yes, we collude together. To try and find strategies to stop our contracts being watered down and nibbled to death by ducks. The airlines do the same thing. They've got IATA. They have these meetings. It's no coincidence that the kind of techniques that they were using on us in Hong Kong here back in the sort of 90s are exactly the same techniques that the management in Qantas are using right now. Of course they're colluding together. In their position, I'd do the same thing. You know, you can't expect these guys to operate in a vacuum. I'd do the same thing. But the answer is yes. They are colluding together to form strategies to lever us down. Equally, we all work together as pilots to form strategies to protect ourselves. So it's a two-way street. But the answer to your question, yes, of course they're colluding. Not that I think not that I think that should stop. It's a fact of life, you know. There's another guy on the balcony over there.
Hi, thank you. My name is Phyllis Steele from the Standard newspaper. Looking back in 2009 when the Court of Appeal reduced the compensation that you and the other pilots are supposed to get by 80% and said that you guys are experiencing distress and anxiety and that the case is not as seriously as defamation and at the severest level, how did you feel about the judge's statement? And are you confident that the Court of Final Appeal is going to overturn the lower court's judgment? Thank you.
Thank you, yes, great. What a great question. I really want the Court of Appeal judges to hear what I say next, don't I? So, how did I feel about it? I was very disappointed, extremely disappointed. However, they're the judges, that was their decision. Very disappointed indeed. Very disappointed. Very, okay? Are we confident about the going to the Court of Final Appeal? Yes, we are. We've been confident since 2001. We're confident that the Court of Appeal, Court of Final Appeal, is going to see the merits of our case and realise the implications of the previous ruling. Clearly, the judge in the High Court saw the merits of our case when he handed down his ruling. I mean, basically, the question was, does the employment ordinance give these people an overriding right over and above the contract? The judge in the High Court said no. The judges in the Court of Appeal said yes. Well, you can't get two more diametrically opposed answers than that. So clearly, it needs to go up to the Court of Final Appeal for a decision. Am I confident? Yes, I am. I am. Yeah, there's this guy.
Sorry, Nick Thompson, what have you been doing since?
Well, a year after I was fired, I had a myocardial infarction, or MI, which effectively means I lost my flying license. I went away and had an angioplasty and a couple of stents put in. That's all fixed. I could have got my flying license back, but bearing in mind I was blacklisted and unlikely to ever get another job in aviation of any comparable status, I made the decision at that point that that my flying career was over. So I've been out of work basically for the last 10 years, but I took up other things, other hobbies. I'm chairman of the executive committee of the Animals Asia Foundation, which Jill Robinson and I, who's sitting over there, set up 14, 15 years ago. That's now a multi-million dollar international organization, a charity. I play keyboards in a pub band. I've done some writing, strangely enough. And I've done a lot of waking up in the morning and thinking, what shall I do today? And going, anything I want. So that's been a quite nice part of it. But then a year ago, just over a year ago, when I thought my aviation career was over, somebody approached me and asked if I'd like to get back into the business and become a flight simulator instructor on the Airbus. And I started doing that, it's a year last October, so I've been doing that for the last 15 months. So now I'm actually back into it in aviation. I'm able to put something back in and I'm teaching people to fly the Airbus. Well, you know, some are still in aviation, some are completely out of aviation. One guy I know, he runs a business importing German windows, you know, sliding windows. So if you want some really good quality sliding windows put in your house, I can get those sorted out for you. Another guy, one of my colleagues, is a truck driver in Canada, HGV truck driver. Some people are back in aviation, but certainly at a lower level than we were in the first tier airline that we were in Cathay Pacific. The guys have put their hands to all sorts of things. So I'd say probably around about a third, probably around about a third are still in aviation. The rest of us have gone off to do other things.
Okay, is that everybody? One more over there, I think. No, he's taking pictures. Down here?
Hello, I'm Becky Kwan. Was the flight attendants unions in Cathay Pacific for about 12 years as chairman. I fully agree with your view that the employment law regarding termination without reasons actually provides an escape route for the employers rather than protection for the employees. I fully agree with that. And with the collusion that the gentleman mentioned previously, and without the sophistication and the ammunition that the pilots have, what do the average man and woman on the street in Hong Kong have? What do you think we should do?
Well, Becky, you know, that's the question, isn't it? The law is there supposedly to protect everyone. But in our experience of the law, you know, if you haven't got the money and the backing, you can't get it done. I mean, it's taken us, you know, 10 years through the courts in Hong Kong. It took us, you know, 8 years through the courts in the UK to get a level of justice. For the average guy in the street who's on his own with no backing, he's I don't want to say he hasn't got a hope, but he's in a very difficult situation. So if people like us, who have the backing, have the resources, have the education to take this on, if we don't take these cases on and do something about it, who is going to do it? No one. So it's up to people like us to stand together and people who do have the backing and the resources to try and make a difference. Because otherwise, nothing will happen. All of this comes with a cost. You know, guys have lost their houses, their families are broken up, you know, their health's been affected. It all comes with a cost. There's three people dead. What kind of cost is that, you know? So all of this comes with a cost. What I would say to you is, if you're going to stand up and take on one of these fights, be prepared for the consequences. Because once you get into it, there's no walking away saying, sorry, I didn't mean it. Once you get into it, you've got to take it all the way through to the end. So I guess the answer to your question is, what can the little guy do? Well, he can rely on the big guys, and hopefully we'll look after the little guys. I hope.
Okay. John, how much have you spent on legal fees from the beginning?
I'm not telling you. Seriously, what, one of the things about this, one of the techniques they try to use all the way through this is to run us out of money. And in fact, Turnbull was quoted as saying, they can't take us on, we're too powerful, we'll just keep on delaying, we'll run them out of money. And one of the things they tried to do in their dirty tricks department was find out what our resources were. And we've been very careful to hide those and make sure they couldn't find out. So, I'm not telling you, is the answer.
Okay, well, unless there's any other questions, I think we'll call it a day. Oh, over here. This gentleman.
I'm Charles McLaughlin. John, I was interested in what you had to say, but I wondered if you would agree. I've been involved in several dismissals, laying offs, call it what you will. You're instructed to behave in a very careful way. You make it clear the person's not been dismissed, they're simply been let go. They've been offered X amount of money, but if they complain or do anything, you'll go back to the government minimum. The quid pro quo of that is there are so many jobs available here, because it is easy to hire and, if necessary, get rid of people as well. Would you see there's a kind of positive side in countries, for example, where there's very draconian labour laws? There aren't that many jobs because no one hires there. Because if you can't get rid of someone, you'd never hire them in the first place. Would you see there's a... I mean, I admire your fight, and I think you've caused some of these changes, but would you say there's a positive side here in that there are more jobs in Hong Kong because of the way the laws are currently structured?
I don't know if there are more jobs in Hong Kong because of the labour structure. Maybe it's more jobs in Hong Kong because we haven't been hit by the worldwide recession, because we're financially very strong here. But I'll go back to what I said earlier about balance to be found. The employer has got to be able to fire people when necessary. And, you know, we're not looking at draconian laws. What we're saying is there should be a balance between the two. And, you know, whenever look at the minimum wage. Whenever somebody mentions minimum wage here, the employers all scream, oh, it'll affect business, it'll affect business. You know, we try and enact pollution legislation, and all the drivers say, oh, that'll affect business. And we have this thing, this culture here that, oh, if it's going to affect business, we better not do it. But equally, it can have a positive effect. If the Cathay pilots contract, I came here in 85, and the contract was constructed over a minimum of a 17-year career with a provident fund at the end. It was clearly a permanent job. There's a promotion structure, a career structure all the way through. So I think anybody who comes here on a contract like that is entitled to expect that he's going to have a full-time permanent job to the termination of his contract. If you come here on a two-year contract saying when the contract's up, that's it, fine. Them's the terms, you know. You come here with your eyes open. But if you come here with an expectation that your contract is going to be adhered to, only to find, when you get here, that an unscrupulous employer can just cut your legs out from under you and leave you to bleed at the side of the road, well, no, that isn't fair, you know. So, yeah, there's a balance. Again, my answer to a question is there should be a balance in these things. And we don't want draconian employment legislation that stops business being done. I agree with you. It's extremism.
Okay, one more question. Over here.
Hi, Martin Donovan. John, in the book you detail some divisions within the union, most notably the full-time general secretary. Do these divisions still linger?
I'm no longer an active member of the AOA. I'm a lifetime honorary member, and as far as I'm aware, the general secretary position still exists. But that's the general secretary is employed by the union as an advisor. He's not actually a pilot, so he's employed by the union as an advisor. Many unions do that. You bring in a general secretary who's got expertise in certain areas. So as far as I'm aware, the AOA still has the gen sec position, yes. Sorry, the divisions?
There seem to be a rift between union members.
Okay, you're talking at a time, all right. In 2000, and what he's referring to is in 2006, the AOA went behind the backs of the 49ers and negotiated a deal with management, which we didn't agree with, and then they tried to force that deal on us, which is why, if you read the book, there's actually only 18 of us left, because the other guys were forced for various reasons to take this deal, such as it was, and it didn't meet any of our objectives. So that remained with 18 of us afterwards. So the division, yes, there was a point where the union became completely divided. You're right. That's in the book. Read about it. Fortunately, some like-minded guys started another union in Hong Kong, the Cathay Pilots Union. And pilots who didn't agree with what the AOA had done and wanted to continue to support us became members of that and continued to help us and support us. So, yeah, there was a... In the middle of all this was an internal war, a civil war went on as well.
Okay, thank you very much, John. All that remains is for me to give you the FCC present.
Oh.
And say thank you very much.
Thanks very much.